Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Hi, folks. It's Peter Bregan. As always, I'm just really happy to be here and to be talking to you. I'm going to skip my usual commentary on things in the world because my guest today is probably the most interesting man I'll ever have on this radio show. We could do a series. We might end up doing a series. His name is Jeffrey Mason. Jeffrey may be known to some of you in the reform field. You should be known to all of you, because he wrote Assault on Truth, which was the first book to disclose how Freud betrayed children, women, and men in that order by covering up child abuse and inventing the Oedipus complex that little kids lust after their parents and aunts and uncles instead of the fact that they're being abused. One of the great betrayals of history that we are still trying to climb our way out of. Jeffrey was at the time the head of the Freud archives. Because of what he wrote, he endured endless attack and assault on himself. I will spare you, but it was horrific. He then decided, my God, if I'm going to be attacked, and maybe he can correct me on this, and if there's going to be all this aggravation, why don't I write about what I want to write about? And what Jeffrey loves probably as much as anything next to his amazing wife are animals. And so Jeffrey went on to write the million-dollar bestseller, When Elephants Weep. Then he wrote Dogs Never Lie About Love. These are wonderful books. Wrote a number of them, and most recently Beasts, which is a book that tries to raise and answer the question, why are we so murderous beyond anything else on the face of the earth? Why are we so murderous? I would ask also, why are we so loving? But to that, Jeffrey says, no, we're the most murderous. He's not sure about the most loving. Now, folks, we could talk about Jeffrey's interests and the ones he shares with me, such as the massive murder of mental patients in Germany that led to the Holocaust, Jung's Nazi sympathies. There's so much we can talk about, but I'm going to just get right into the heart of these deeper issues about love, violence, humanity, and animals. Jeffrey, I don't know why I haven't had you on the show 10 times already, let alone not once. Jeff's in Spain. He's been in Australia, New Zealand, mostly New Zealand. This is probably why we haven't been in better touch. Hi.
Hi, Peter. It's wonderful to be talking to you again. I really miss you. I can still remember when you and I were in Germany together, traveling around, going to a wonderful conference, and just hanging with one another, meeting people who supposedly were the same, were interested in the same things, but we found in the end it was just you and me who saw it the same way, I'm afraid. But I have a very deep fond spot for you, Peter, and I followed, of course, all your books, and it was the first time I ever realized there was such a thing. When I was being trained as a Freudian psychoanalyst in 1970 in Toronto, Canada, one of the first non-medical people there to be trained, and I suddenly became aware of what you were doing around ECT, and it just blew my mind. It really opened up a whole new way of thinking, and I remember saying to the psychiatrist there in my class, these are the books we should be reading. These are the articles we need. We need to understand why any psychiatrist would do something as horrible as that to the human mind. And they looked at me as if I had lost mine. And I realized that they did not share my views at all. And so that was the beginning of my introduction to anti-psychiatry. and the things you wrote about it, the things you did to stop brain disabling therapies, as you call them, is just magnificent. We'll be remembered forever, Peter. I'm so proud to have you as a friend.
Well, thank you, Jeff. Let me briefly tell folks about the German trip. Many years back, just before the Berlin Wall came down, not long before it came down, there was the first conference ever in Germany on the role of medicine in the Third Reich. And Jeffrey is fluent in German, and he and I had been researching together the issues of what psychiatry had done in creating the so-called euthanasia camps that became extermination camps eventually. And I gave a talk on that. Jeffrey gave a talk on what's his name? Carl Jung and his Nazi sympathizing, if not greater than sympathy. And we just had a wonderful time in Germany. But I want to dive into today, and that's a teaser. If Jeff's willing, I'm going to have him back on these separate topics. But I want to talk about what's nearest and dearest to Jeffrey's heart right now, and in many ways to my own. And he's got a new book out called Beasts, but it's not really a book show, but it just fits. Jeff, what are your thoughts about on our being the most violent creature on Earth? And my hypothesis that we're the most loving, which I think is challengeable, and I think you're going to challenge it. So
yeah.
Let me hear from you.
I do and do not want to challenge that, because certainly you're right. I mean, we just don't know. My own experience has been that when it comes to certain kinds of positive emotions, there are animals who are our superior. It's very hard for any human to hear this, to accept that, because it really is a deep blow to our narcissism and our vanity. I mean, we like to believe we're at the absolute pinnacle of God's creation when it comes to intelligence, and that may well be so, but then if you start thinking about what about emotions, almost everybody you talk to will say, well, of course, no animal has the complex emotions we have. And that's just not true. It's clear that many of them do. And I think that's becoming more and more acceptable, even among zoologists and animal scientists. But I want to take that one step further, Peter. I believe that there are certain emotions for which animals are our superior. And that's what is difficult for people to swallow. And I'm thinking in particular, and many of the people listening to this probably will recognize that it's true to some extent, that dogs, for example, when it comes to sheer friendliness, there is no human as consistently friendly and open and kind as a dog. Now, of course, there are dogs who are raised to fight, and there are dogs who have miserable lives, and they're not like that. But when a dog has a good companion, a good human companion and other canine friends, the amount of friendship that they display is just extraordinary, and it never seems to end. I'm living now in Malaga, Spain with my family, and when we go walking along the beach, a lot of people have dogs here, and you see them, the minute they see another dog, they're straining at the leash. Let me meet that dog. And we don't do that. I'm a little bit lonely here in Malaga because I don't know anyone. And I just don't walk up to people and say, hi, I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Jeff, and here's what I'm interested in. Who are you, and what are you interested in? We just don't do that as a species. But dogs do it all the time, constantly. And, of course, they like also meeting other people. Their tails wag, and, you know, their eyes shine bright, and it's like, this is what I'm here for. So I think when it comes, so you said love, and I think love is slightly different, and I probably agree with you, but would also add that we just don't know, for example, how much love, say, a mother orca is capable of towards her young calf, or a mother elephant. And I suspect it's as great as ours, and possibly even greater.
What about unconditional love? I think you and I have had an interesting correspondence about whether or not dogs entered our evolutionary development in order to teach us unconditional love.
Well, yeah. I like the way you put that, Peter. Yes.
What about that?
Well, I mean, you know, the mystery is this, that we'd always believed up until fairly recently that dogs were certainly, that was general agreement, the first animal, quote, that we domesticated. But now, and that was, say, I don't know, 7,000 years ago, but now there's good evidence that that's not true, that it goes back much further than that. The latest research is somewhere around 35,000 years, and there are scientists, respectable scientists, in the Department of Genetics at UCLA who say, no, it's much further. It goes back at least 50,000, and 50,000 is the exact same time that humans became what we recognize today as modern humans. So it is possible that we became the humans that we now are because we allied ourselves with dogs, or dogs allied themselves with us, because it's not clear how exactly it happened. We know that dogs came from wolves, and now we have a sense of when this might have happened. But it's not at all clear who took the first step. Was it the wolf or humans? And now, of course, dogs are different than wolves. And the latest research, I don't know if you saw this, Peter, it was fascinating. A few days ago, a series of scientific findings out of Japan showed that when dogs stare at us, and they're the only animal, by the way, into whose eyes we can stare without causing them to be nervous and vice versa. In other words, we're looking at them not as a predator. There's no predator-prey relationship there, but of one of love. Just as we look into our beloved's eyes, so we look into the eyes of dogs. And when we do that, they discovered that our oxytocin level rises in both the dog and the human. So that they've actually measured it. And when we look into each other's eyes, we get into this kind of upward spiral of love that just goes on and on. And that's really quite astonishing. We don't have that with any other animal. Now, they haven't measured, and I suspect that'll be the next thing, whether that happens between dogs, but I'm sure it does. Why wouldn't it? And it's a little bit like a mother and her child, you know, that just, it's in this wonderful feedback loop of positive feelings. And that certainly is love. There's no other word for that.
I love this. One of the things that I think I wrote you about a little bit earlier is that there's also some research suggesting now that that dogs really don't come from wolves, that there's a common ancestor. And that might explain some of the huge differences between wolves and dogs.
You're right. I mean, what I meant to say that I forgot to mention, that you can tame a wolf, as everyone knows. And you can have quite a close relationship with a tame wolf. I've seen this many times and been in wolf sanctuaries and seen the people that live with them. And they look very much like dogs. They behave very much like dogs. But in the research that they did in Japan, people who were very close to dogs could not, the oxytocin level did not rise in the wolf when they looked at the human, nor in the human. So it's a different relationship. In other words, wolves and humans do not have that close bond. So, yes, you're right. I mean, it could be a different common ancestor, or it could be now that the dog is simply a different animal than the wolf. On the other hand, they will mate, as you know, and they can be quite close. A pure wolf and a dog can become good friends. Not often, but it can happen. So they're very close, even if they're not the same species. But yes, a dog is now a different species. And I would say that a dog is more like a human than any other animal.
To a certain extent, they're
more like our children. I mean, even the most senior dog, mature dog, still has a kind of relationship where he behaves like a child with us, that he expects us. And one of the things that the Japanese researchers found that I thought was so cute is that if you give a dog a problem they cannot solve, and you give a three-year-old a problem that he or she cannot solve, both of them will look at you for help, like, hey, Dad, what do you expect me to do here?
That's so beautiful,
they
Jeff.
Behave
That's
towards
beautiful.
Us like children, and we treat them like children, like loved children.
And then when they get old, we treat them like treasured elders. That's interesting.
Very much so, very much so. And we can't let go. I mean, people grieve very deeply over the loss of a dog, which I completely understand. And the dogs also grieve over the loss of their human. It's quite real. So there's another area, by the way, where I think it's possible that elephants, for example, grieve even more deeply than do humans over their lost loved ones.
Describe it.
Well, the evidence that I got comes from the work of Cynthia Moss, who's one of the great elephant researchers in the world today. She's in Amboseli and still works there. And one of her first books, I think it was called Elephant Family. I'm not quite sure the name any longer, but it's a marvelous book. Cynthia Moss, M-O-S-S. And she describes there a herd of elephants that was walking past her camp. And there was the bone of a female elephant. And it was the temple. And the elephants all sniffed the bone and walked on. But one small elephant did not want to leave. He picked up the bone. He held it for a long time. He smelled it. He caressed it. And only very reluctantly let it go. And Cynthia Moss, who observed this, was intrigued. And because she had such good records, she was able to discover that that small elephant was the child of the dead mother. And the child, this elephant child, recognized her mother by simply touching the remaining bone. And presumably, because elephants are very tactile and show their love for one another by constantly massaging and touching and feeling one another, this baby elephant recognized the shape of her mother's skull. And I don't think there's anything quite parallel to that in human grief.
Wow. I'm just sort of speechless listening. Do you think, Jeff, that that we could make a case now that this is new data that I hadn't heard about, going back 50,000 years for the existence of dogs? Maybe we could make a case that there is this coevolution that's taken place that has given us...
Definitely. Definitely. That's the word we want. It is a form of coevolution. So we have given them things that wolves don't have, and they have given us things that we wouldn't have without them. So, but then here's the mystery then. Okay, granted that's the case, and I think right from the beginning, you know, let's say it's 50,000 years ago, and there we are with the dog. I think it's not just that the dog served as a sentinel. That we've always known, and they still do that. You know, dogs are tremendous guards. You know, this is our house, and I want to make sure that nobody with intent to harm comes in here. There are children in this house, you know, I'm not going to let them in. So dogs do that, and they probably did that when we were living in caves. They probably stood right at the entrance to make sure we were safe at night. So that was a good reason to have a dog. It's also true that dogs are much superior hunters. I don't like hunting. As you know, I'm a vegan, but there was no period in our early human history when humans did not hunt to some extent. There were no vegans 50,000 years ago, that's for sure. And in that hunting endeavor, dogs were much better than we were and helped us, and we shared with them. So those were the two main functions. And they kept us warm, you know, in very cold weather in the winter when you're sleeping and you have six dogs around you, you'd be much better off than any blanket. But I also believe, and for this there is no evidence as far as we know, but I also am convinced that they were also our friends from the very beginning, that they wagged their tails, that they looked up at us with love, that their eyes shone bright, that they were glad to see us in the morning. They liked sharing their bed with us. They trusted us completely. And that was something that we couldn't get from anything else. No other animal gave us that. And sometimes not even our own family gave us that. And this is why, Peter, you would know this even better than I, being a clinician, that there are many children who are abused whose only friend is a dog, because they feel that the dog loves them, the dog would never abuse them, the dog understands them, the dog cares about them, the dog feels compassion for them. And I think that's true. And I think dogs have always fulfilled that function. I don't think there's ever been a period in our history when people who live with dogs have not recognized their ability to give us this unconditional love.
I would bet anything, if we could go back in time, that it all begins with a hunter bringing home a puppy for his children, and that it all begins with the puppy and the children loving each other and playing together, and that it begins with that, with affection, rather than or simultaneously with some of the more practical things, because puppies are so loving and
that's right. Well,
and
good
innocent
point.
And adorable.
Peter, you made a good point. That's right. And you make the point that a puppy, after all, is not going to be much use in hunting. And a puppy is not even going to be much of a guard dog. So, you know, what were they there for? They were there to give. They're just adorable. Nobody can resist a puppy.
Now, this new data of if we can trace dogs back 50,000 years, that puts them 40,000 years before we even have cities. It puts them back,
that's right,
as you said, at the latest limits of Homo sapiens. People view Homo sapiens as evolving to our present state, more or less 50 to up to 150,000 or so years ago. So it puts the dogs
right
there before we have a lot of evidence for spirituality. It puts the dogs there at the very dawn of our civilization.
Well, right, the very dawn. I mean, if we say that Homo sapiens sapiens, as we know him today, when there has been very little genetic change, that's about 50,000 years ago. So that's about when we first domesticated dogs. And there's a very, very serious new book. I don't know the name. I haven't actually read it, but by somebody called Pat Shipman. And I notice a lot of the reviews, her thesis is exactly that, that the reason that humans, the modern humans, were able to become the dominant species among the different kinds of humans is because we had dogs and the others did not. Now, why that should be, we don't know. But Neanderthals did not have dogs. They were every bit as intelligent as we were. They were certainly bigger and stronger than we were. And yet they did not survive, and we did. And Pat Shipman, who's a very serious physical anthropologist, her thesis is the reason for that is we had dogs and Neanderthals did not.
This is so interesting. Now, I forget who, which Spaniard invaded South America and took down the Inca Empire. And they did it in part, small numbers of men, because they had dogs, and those Native Americans did not have dogs. Does that memory sound right to you?
Gee, you know, I don't know, Peter. I'm glad you brought it up, because it's something well worth thinking about. I don't remember reading.
I think it was Pizarro, and I
that,
think he...
That they had, I know they had horses, of course.
So they had, they brought these vicious dogs with them, and the Native Americans, but and Central America, were terrified of them.
That would make sense. Well, I mean, look, if you just look at these Tibetan Mastiffs, for example, these giant dogs that can weigh up to 200 pounds, I mean, they're very, you know, no animal. They're used to guard the flocks in Tibet and now in parts of China, and they're absolutely ferocious, while at the same time very loving to humans. There's no animal that's going to approach a flock when those dogs are guarding them.
Folks, I'm talking with my old friend, Jeffrey Mason. All of his books are worth reading. I have read more of Jeffrey's books than any other modern author. As much as I love dogs, I've always had dogs. And I'm one of those people who was probably closer to his dog than his own rest of his family at big times when I was young. Jeffrey's books have helped me love and appreciate my dogs even more than I did. And this is just the beginning of who Jeffrey is. This is just a piece of who this man is. When we'll go to break in about a minute or two, Jeff. We'll take a 2 or 3 minute break. And you and I will be able to talk briefly during the break. And as we come back, let's go to the other side of our violent nature. And, of course, we've taught dogs to be violent, which is interesting. And your book, Beasts, and about human violence. I had an interesting review. I submitted an article based on my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, an article to a medical journal called Medical Hypotheses, and it's published now, so that my theory of the evolution, biological evolution, guilt, shame, and anxiety is now in the medical literature. One of the reviewers was a feminist, and she was outraged at what I was writing about our being inherently violent, because she wanted to say that all violence in human beings comes from patriarchy, and that, in fact, you can't even study civilization to prove humans are violent, because civilization has always been patriarchal in its basic structure. And it would be very interesting, because I know that you too are very, very much a feminist and imbued with that literature. I remember way back when you first started reading it and we were talking about it. So that'd be another thing to look at in the second half of the hour is violence just plain old built in biologically, like I believe it is, or is it a learned phenomena? The feminists would like us to believe that. Some political orientations would like us to believe that if we could just change our environment, we'd be perfect, or at least we wouldn't be so violent and hateful. Jeffrey Mason, Jeff, what's the best way for people to look you up on the web?
You can go to my website, jeffreymason.com, www.jeffreymason.com. Remember, it's with two S's. And
M-A-S-S-O-N,
folks. Yeah, you just put that into Google, lots of stuff will come up. Mostly it's about animals now, but there's stuff about the Freud, and there's stuff about my lawsuit that reached the U.S. Supreme Court against the New Yorker and Janet Malcolm. So, you know, there are lots of them. But I'm fascinated by what you've just said, Peter, and I'd be glad to talk about that after the break.
Let's go to break now. My marvelous engineer, Giselle, take us to break, and Jeff and I will chat a little bit, get ready to come and talk with you again. with a man whom I think is among the most interesting men walking around today. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. And I was just in the midst in my brief break with a conversation with Jeff Mason, my marvelous guest, an old friend. And I think we just pick up where we left off. Jeff, you had something you were very interested in. Maybe it was about the feminism issues or the violence issues. And let's just jump into the subject.
I'm very interested in that. I'm very interested because, I tell you, I think the one area where you and I might disagree, and of course this is a very controversial issue, it's not just you and I who disagree with it, just about everybody who enters this field, you know, there are two very, very different points of view. One is that we have always been a violent species, right from the very beginning. And the other one is, and I don't agree with that, I think there was a period when we were modern humans about 50,000 years ago with dogs, when we were less violent. And there was no such thing, I'm sure you've said, and I'm sure you're probably right, that there was always interpersonal violence, obviously. But I don't believe that there was any such thing as war. I think war has a beginning. And here I'm very much of the opinion of Brian Ferguson, who, in my opinion, is the greatest researcher on the history of war. And he has this phrase that just deeply impressed me. He said, "War has to be learned. It is something that is taught." And I think he's right. And, you know, nobody knows exactly when war began, but it's somewhere around 5, 6, maybe 7,000 years ago. Now, that's not that long ago, you know, when you consider that we've been around for, as you say, at least 150,000 years, but even as a modern species, as very much like we are today, for 50,000 years, and for, you know, 45 of those 1,000 years, we weren't going to war. Now, part of the reason is because there was nothing to be gained by it. Until you had agriculture 10,000 years ago, you didn't really have people living in villages. They weren't accumulating anything. They didn't have animals. They didn't have crops. So there'd be no reason to invade another group of people because what would you get from them? They were just like you, wandering through the forest, trying to survive very much the way any animal in the forest survives today. Their time was spent, some of it, of course, socializing, but most of the time they're trying to find enough to eat and survive. And that's what we did for 45,000 years ago, or 40,000. And then 10,000 years ago, and coincidentally, and that's the thesis of my book, Beasts, What Animals Can Teach Us About the Origins of Good and Evil, is that I think evil entered the world just at the period that we started domesticating, not dogs, goes back much earlier, but other animals, cows and pigs and sheep and goats and chickens. Because we did that not to have a friend, but in order to make it easier for us to kill these animals for food. And I think that began a long trek that has finally come to a halt today in the horrors of factory farming. And that's something you and I have talked about before, that leads to what I regard as the greatest of human vices, namely greed. We want more than we need. We want more than our neighbor has. We want more than is good for us. And we don't care what we do to other people to get it, and we don't care what we do to other animals to get it. And that's why, you know, nobody can bear to enter a slaughterhouse. Nobody wants to see these videos that, fortunately, people brave enough to go into these into these chicken farms to see what they do is just horrendous. We don't want to see that. We don't want to think of ourselves as that cruel, but we are. Now, you can't say that everybody who eats meat is cruel. That would be wrong. But you can say that everybody who eats meat is avoiding a certain problem. That is, they're not wanting to face where that meat comes from and what is involved in getting it, namely murder. And you see, that goes way back. That didn't happen. Sure, when we were hunter-gatherers, we would kill animals. But it was rare, Peter, because it was dangerous. You know, these guys would go out hunting, but meanwhile, the women would do all the gathering, and that's where they got most of their food from. The women were busy digging up roots and fruits and shoots and fruit, wild fruits. And the men would go out once in a while. They would kill an animal. But it was fairly, nobody knows, maybe once a week, once a month, because it was dangerous. These are big animals. You know, if you think about what a cow's like today, sure, you walk up to a cow, but you wouldn't have done that when the cow was a wild animal, because first of all, she'd have a bull around and you wouldn't stand a chance. So, but once we, quote, domesticated them, that is, enslaved them, then of course we could do anything we want. You didn't have to be brave. You don't have to be brave to kill a chicken today or a lamb or a goat or yet a cow, any of these animals. And so something happened to us. It unleashed a kind of greed in us. And coincidentally, by the way, it is also destroying our planet slowly. And now suddenly, even an Al Gore is aware of that. You know, we realize we can't go on like this. But I think it all started around 10,000 years ago when we domesticated animals, not in the way we domesticated dogs and cats. See, those were the two animals that were domesticated in a different way. And maybe because, as you suggested, Peter, it was a co-evolution. The dogs wanted to be with us, and so did cats. And that's why we are so close to them in ways that we are not with other animals.
Well, two things occur to me that are a little counter to this, to your thesis. One, of course, is what we're both familiar with is, the chimpanzees of Gombe with that marvelous woman whose name I'm blocking on.
Jane Goodall.
With Jane Goodall, and she thought that the chimps didn't do anything remotely like warfare. And then one band of chimps was smaller than the other, broke off, and was trying to live on the outskirts of where the big band was. And the big band systematically killed them off, except for the young females, you know, reproductive age, just killed off the males and the children. And so I can see that even just the possession I hadn't thought of this before, Jeff, just the possession of women is one of the reasons why males perpetrate warfare. The other thought I had, and then I want to give it back to you, is the Native American tribes, who are probably anthropologically, they're the group I've read the most about. They just had all kinds of forms of warfare, and they were pretty ancient societies. They had some had agriculture. Some mainly gathered fish and stuff on the shores, and some were mainly hunters. I think especially, though, that's after the horse arrives, and I think they come over with the Europeans.
That's right.
So,
yeah.
But I mean, there's a lot of warfare going on in North America when Europeans got here. So I'm just not sure, but it's a very interesting and important issue. Go ahead.
Definitely. It is important. I don't know, and I'm not sure anybody else knows, whether American Indians, when they were pure hunter-gatherers, before there had been any contact, whether there was warfare or not.
I think that's pretty clear, Jeff. I read, you know, the early explorers.
Yeah. Okay.
And there was warfare. In fact, the Iroquois Federation was set up.
No, I know, but we're talking a few thousand years. I'm thinking about, you know, when did they come over? Probably 30, 40,000 years ago. Same with the Australians. At that point, and I've asked this about Australians
too, and not gotten a clear
answer.
No, we don't know.
Whether 30 or 40,000 years ago there would have been such a thing as warfare among any indigenous people. And, you know, that's very controversial because the people that study hunter-gatherers today are also divided. There are people like Ferguson and others who say, no, there wasn't such a thing as warfare. And then there are others who say, well, yes, they were, and there always have been. So, and I don't know if you know Steven Pinker's book, which is one of my least favorite books,
yes.
The Angels of Our Nature, where he claims why violence has declined. I don't believe it has. It's only declined if you're willing to define it as things that take place in Northern Europe. Yeah, that's probably true. But if you look around the world today, violence is as great as it has ever been. And by the way, he more or less ignores the Holocaust. I don't know how he gets away with that. He has a phrase that just appalled me in that book. He said, nobody in Germany except Hitler and a few of his henchmen thought it was a good idea to get rid of the Jews. Well, that's just abysmally ignorant.
I missed that. I would have probably torn his book up. I missed that when I was skimming it. Let's get more into this idea of how violent we are compared to other species. We've talked about the love issue. There really isn't any species, at least at present time, that looks as violent as we. And going back, say, 500,000 years, we were already a dominant carnivore type of creature, killing mammoths and even earlier creatures than mammoths, I guess. But so talk about that some. Human beings as violent creatures.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the what I look at in the book. What I wanted to look at is we are called an apex predator, a supreme predator, mostly because of our weapons. And, you know, however old they go, I mean, there was always a time, or practically always, and I'm probably at least 500,000 years, when we had primitive weapons, and that gave us the advantage that we didn't have in our bodies. I mean, we don't have claws, we don't have fangs, in no way are we physically comparable to a wolf or just about any other apex predator. So an apex predator, by definition, is the animal that in its own niche is at the top of the food chain. And there are several hundred of them, but the main ones are the big cats and wolves and orcas, for example. And in fact, orcas, it comes closer to us than to any other animal, because just as we are the dominant predator on land, the orca is the dominant predator in the sea, in the oceans. Now, when you look at, I've been always fascinated by orcas, and I make a point of talking to orca researchers whenever I can. And my first question is always this: are you aware of any instance where an orca in the wild has killed another orca? And the answer is, gee, now that you mention it, no, I'm not. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. But as far as anyone knows, there's no recorded instance of an orca causing the death of another orca. Now, if you look at the human species, in the 20th century alone, at least 200 million people have been killed by other human beings. So contrast this with the orca. Here we are, we're both apex predators, but the orca does not kill its own species, and we do, to the tune of 200 million. So the question then becomes, what happened to us? Why are we like that? Why is no other apex predator even remotely like that? I mean, yes, they kill. I mean, orcas kill. But they kill for one reason only, to eat. No other animal kills for fun. No animal, I mean, obviously wouldn't pay them to go out hunting for the sheer pleasure of killing an animal and then not eating it. That's dangerous. So no animal does that. Even tigers and lions don't do it. No animal. Only we do it. We go out armed with guns, and we shoot animals just to put them on our wall. So,
Jeff, let me interrupt.
Magnitude.
Jeff, don't cats, yes. domesticated cats, kill for fun and toy with their prey?
Well, that's debatable. What I've looked into this, obviously, as you can imagine, because it's fascinating. For one thing, they're domesticated, so we can't say that they're doing what they did in the wild. They have noted, and even orcas will do this, by the way, will apparently play with an animal and kill it. And
that's what I thought. I've seen pictures of that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, what Ingrid Visser showed in observing that is what people failed to notice, and she did, is that there were baby calves present, and they were being taught what to do. So a mother orca says, look, this is how you handle an animal when you want to eat it. This is how you kill it. And the same with cats.
Let me get you back now. Yeah. You're saying what went wrong with us. I interrupted that important theme. What went wrong with us?
Well,
what went wrong with us,
that's the big question. That's the big question, Peter. My theory, and I told it to you earlier, and it's only a theory, and most people would not accept it, of course, is that this began about 10,000 years ago when we domesticated plants and we domesticated animals. But you can ask, okay, but why? Why would this unleash greed in us? Why couldn't we have just, continued as we had always continued, eating plants from the forest? Or even when we did start planting, why did that make us start killing animals in such huge numbers, to the point where it's ended up today as this unimaginable, we kill something like 60 billion animals a year around the world. So what happened to us? Why are we doing that? And I don't have an answer, Peter. And I don't believe that it's, quote, simply part of our nature. I don't also believe that it's patriarchy, although I would agree with your feminist, I guess she wasn't a friend, but the person who disagreed with you, I would agree that we've had this problem with the other from the very beginning of our existence, and women are often the other for men. But you see, it's even older than that, because we have women as the other. We have children as the other, as you've been quick to point out. We certainly have had Jews as the other. We've had, people who live 10 miles away from us as the other, people with a different skin color, people with a different religion, people of a different class, people of a different ethnicity, people of a different political persuasion. All of those people become other. Now, why do we have this us-them dichotomy so deeply built into us that it seems almost impossible to get rid of it? You look at dogs, and they look at us, and they don't see a them. They don't have an us-them. Now, we can train them to do that. Certainly wolves do it, and we can train a dog to beware of strangers. But by and large, what dogs want to do is to be friends with everyone. They want to be friends with other dogs, and they want to be friends with other humans. And if you give them the chance, they'll be friends with cats and ducks and any other animal you introduce them to. So, and that's kind of that. That's what I was talking about, that evolutionary spiral, that beneficial spiral that they've seemed to master better than we have, with some exceptions. I'm not a great believer in sainthood, but some people, my wife, for example, just seem to have an endless flow of love. And it just doesn't, they feel it towards children and other people, and they just don't seem to have viciousness and hostility. And obviously there are people like that. There were even people like that during the Holocaust. There were Germans who saved Jews. There were Italian priests who saved Jews. There are people who risk their lives and do it all the time. There, even firemen, you know, and when 9/11 happened, who risk their lives to save other people. So, you know, it's not that every member of our species is awful. But there is a trend. And I'm, you know, I wish I could believe with Steven Pinker that violence is decreasing in our species, but I don't believe that. And I would like to understand why not. And I would like to get to the bottom of this, Peter, but, and that's why I wrote that book, but I certainly didn't solve the problem.
Oh, I'm just sitting here taking deep breaths. Folks, I'm going to be having Jeffrey back. We're going to be discussing things like the role of psychiatry in the Holocaust, something Jeffrey and I have both researched, and Jeffrey's researched as someone who is fluent in German and spent more time in Germany. We'll be back and talk about, at another time, Freud's betrayal of men, women, and children, which I think has set back an understanding of child abuse by decades and decades. I would recommend so strongly that if you're interested in psychology and how we managed to avoid realizing for so long that children were traumatized by abuse on a regular basis. Go back and look at Jeffrey's book, God, I'm blocking on the name of your book, so repeat it loud.
The Assault on Truth.
And if you want just enjoyable reading, pick up any of his books about animals, When Elephants Weep, Dogs Never Lie About Love, and Now Beasts, and others. There are others as well. Jeffrey is a champion of animals. You are genuinely, Jeffrey, a champion of animals. In a few words, I know what I want to ask you, but we have only about 2 minutes. I know in the beginning of thinking about dogs, it seems to me that you felt we took advantage of them and that it wasn't a fair relationship. And I know that you've had trenchant things to say about how we breed dogs to have stunted legs and things like that. Are you feeling a little better now about the relationship between humans and dogs, or do you still think it's basically exploitation?
I think that more and more people do not want an exploitative relationship with a dog, and that's wonderful, that we are more and more regarding them as members of the family. So, for example, I think that a lot of businesses are allowing dogs to come to work, which makes sense. People who have dogs are not excluding them from the house. They're not even excluding them from the bedroom. They're not even excluding them from the bed, because that's where a dog wants to be, wants to sleep with you, right next to you, just like a young child does. And it's one of the most beautiful experiences on earth to be lying in bed with a dog who completely trusts you, falls asleep, has his dreams while you're holding him. I believe that it's one of the most beautiful experiences we can have is living with dogs. There are people, of course, who exploit them, and there still is dog fighting in the United States, but almost nobody thinks that's a good thing.
Give us a peek at anything you're writing now.
Well, you know, Peter, it's interesting you should ask me, because just today I decided that I want to try my hand for the first time and write a novel. And I want to write it about an event that happened during the Holocaust, but something that will allow me to talk about dogs and child abuse and psychiatry and Freud and even Jung, and anti-Semitism, and the courage and bravery, and it's just utterly fascinating to me. It brings up so many issues, and the ultimate question that I have in that book is, what allows some human beings to remain indifferent to the suffering of other human beings. That, to me, is that great puzzle that you and I have been talking about. We see it in the relationship of the killing of mental patients in Germany. We see it in the United States when they do ECT to patients or give them drugs that are going to harm them. We see it even in somebody like Biederman, I hope I won't get sued, you know, announcing that two-year-olds can have manic depression. I mean, this is a complete loss of compassion and empathy, and I want to understand where that comes from. And, you know, I'd said before, I think it's greed, but that wouldn't explain everything, would it, Peter? So
no,
I think that's something that you and I...
I don't think it does.
I need to explore that further, yeah.
But good old Biederman from Harvard, he was getting a lot of money under the table from Johnson & Johnson to promote the antipsychotic drugs like Risperdal for children. So greed plays a role.
Yeah.
Power plays a role. Control, violence.
Yeah.
I think objectivity plays a role. I think whenever we strive to be objective about human beings, we end up hating them. We have to love human beings. We can't be objective.
We do.
My guest.
We do, Peter.
Thank you for being on the show.
Peter.